everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. This is It's All About Food, July 23rd, 2013. And this is the second part of our show. I want to remind you, you can send questions, comments during the show or anytime during the week, info@realmeals.org. I never get enough emails. I love to have conversations with all of you. So let's talk. Okay. Now, on to the next part of the show. Norm Phelps, a frequent speaker at animal rights conferences. He is the author of Changing the Game, Why the Battle for Animal Liberation is So Hard and How We Can Win It. Also, The Longest Struggle, Animal Advocacy from Pythagoras to PETA, The Great Compassion, Buddhism and Animal Rights, and The Dominion of Love, Animal Rights, according to the Bible, and they were all published by Lantern Books. He has contributed numerous articles to journals and anthologies, including Call to Compassion and Earth, Animal, and Disability Liberation, The Rise of the Eco-Ability Movement. And he's a regular contributor to the Dharma Voices for Animals website. Norm is a member of the Institute for Critical Animal Studies, a regular contributor to the website Dharma Voices for Animals, and a founding member of the Society of Ethical and Religious Vegetarians. He's a practicing Tibetan Buddhist and Unitarian Universalist. He lives in Funkstown, Maryland, with his wife, Patty Rogers, and their family of rescued cats. Norm, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Karen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I just finished reading Changing the Game, Why the Battle for Animal Liberation is So Hard and How We Can Win It. And let's talk a bit about that, shall we?
Love to.
Okay, so I want you to know, my listeners may know this, that I became a vegan over 25 years ago. I was already vegetarian, and the motivating factor for me was not wanting to kill animals. That's how I came to the scene. I've become very passionate about the health benefits of a vegan plant-based diet and the powerful, gentle effects it has on the environment. It's a win-win-win all around. Okay, I'm back. I'm sorry about that. That's technology for you. Norm, are you with me?
I'm here.
Okay, that was fun.
Indeed.
Okay, I was saying that I got into this whole movement because I didn't want to kill animals, and then I found out about all the other benefits to eating a plant-based diet and how good it was for the environment. But, you know, I focus on so many different things in trying to get the message. I spent the last half hour with Dr. Pam Popper talking about the power of plant foods on health because I'm looking for any angle I can to attract people to not killing animals. But it's a very hard sell, and I want to win it.
I could not agree more. As you say, different messages appeal to different people, and different messages appeal to the same people at different times. I think we have to use every tool in our toolkit.
I want to believe, and I got this feeling from your book, that we will win. It's just going to take time.
It is going to take a very long time.
And I've spoken with lots of different people on this show, and some of them have been hardcore animal rights activists, and others have been believers in the animal welfare process. And you talk about how both are actually necessary.
I think that's right. Animal liberation, animal rights, is the most deeply entrenched form of oppression in history, ever, anywhere. Mm. Both deeply embedded in our individual psychology and in our culture. And we're not going to overcome that in a matter of a few years or probably even a few decades. Just as the struggle for the abolition of human slavery and the liberation of women were struggles for centuries, I think the animal liberation struggle is too. And we just have to be prepared for the long haul.
you bring up some interesting points, and one is that all of these other social movements, the people that were moving them forward had self-interest at stake. Women pushed forward in the women's movement to improve their life situation. People in the civil rights movement, the same thing. But animals don't have a voice.
Darren, try to imagine a movement for the abolition of human slavery that depended entirely on converting slave owners to the cause. And that is precisely the situation that the animal rights movement is in. About 3% of the population is vegan. The adult American population is vegan, 2 to 3%. And that means that 98 to 97% feel that they benefit personally from animal slavery and slaughter. And that's the population that we have to convert.
Well, you know, when you put it that way, and unfortunately people don't put it that way enough, people benefit from animal slavery and slaughter.
Yes, they do.
You know, we need to hear more of that language, telling it like it is.
Some of the benefits are imaginary, fanciful, but deeply believed, which is all that matters, and some are real. But they are there, and they are what keep people oppressing animals. We oppress animals because we like the benefits of it. We feel we benefit from it. We enjoy it. It satisfies our appetites. It's convenient. We make money off of it. And we can get away with it. There are no adverse consequences to oppressing animals. And that is basically why we do it.
You give some brief history. Well, it's not even that brief. You give some pretty comprehensive history on social movements to improve people's lots and how humans have engaged since we began, and our history isn't very nice.
It is a very long, very slow, and very indirect path that social justice movements have always had to take. There is a very deep strain of selfishness embedded in the human psyche, and it is very difficult to overcome. But there is also a very deep strain of empathy and compassion embedded in the human psyche, and that's what we have to appeal to. And I believe we can successfully, although, as you say, it will not be a quick or an easy process.
It's that embedded word, you know? How do we bring out what we want and not the rest? It's a big challenge. All right. There's a number of different things. I'm looking for them in your book that I highlighted that I wanted to talk about. The animal rights movement is exploring uncharted territory. We are attempting to be the first social justice movement in history to succeed without the organized, conscious participations of the victims. I kind of alluded to that a moment ago, but
it does have another aspect that we didn't talk about, and that is this. Try to imagine a women's movement that was staffed, if you will, made up entirely and led entirely by men with no mechanism to get feedback from women on whether the tactics were working, whether it was succeeding, even whether the goals were what they really wanted. Or try to imagine a civil rights movement made up entirely of whites with no mechanism to get feedback from African Americans. That's what we're trying to do in the animal rights movement, and it's the first time in history that anything of that sort has been undertaken.
Which is rather exciting.
Yes, it is. We're pioneers in ways that we might wish we weren't.
All right, you have a section called The Shock of Recognition, the realization that we are all mass murderers who have lived our entire lives off of the fruits of the most gruesome and widespread slavery and murder ever practiced by human beings generates intense, often unbearable emotional distress.
Yes.
And that some people, if they realize it consciously or subconsciously, rather than face that truth, will continue doing the same thing and finding justifications for it.
The enormity of our crime against non-human animals is such that when you recognize that it is a crime, that they are sentient, sensitive beings like us who long for happiness and have a deep aversion to pain, who long for continued life and dread death just as we do, then that is an extraordinarily painful recognition. And rather than face it, most people simply lash out at the messenger, deny the message without really listening to it, and continue to commit the crime, because if they stopped committing the crime, they'd have to admit that it was a crime to themselves, and they just can't bear the pain of that.
I never thought of it that way, and it was very interesting reading it. It takes a lot of courage.
It takes a lot of courage. Yes, it does.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of ability to be forgiving of yourself and of others.
Yeah, be forgiving of yourself, be forgiving of your parents who raised you a certain way and all the people that have nurtured you.
Indeed it does. And yeah. All of our political, philosophical, and entertainment era, you know, it takes a lot of forgiveness, and forgiveness takes courage.
Okay, you talk about creating a universal rights movement, and your argument, you say, in parts one and two of your book, has been that animal rights has made such slow progress during its first 35 years because of inherent difficulty of the challenge and the ascendancy of a conservative political philosophy that is hostile to all social justice movements.
Absolutely. I think the importance of that fact, of this historical thing, is very much overlooked within the animal rights movement. Nearly all of the social progress for human beings that was made in this country was made during a very short period, one generation really, one and a half generations, between the 1930s, the New Deal, and the 1960s, the Civil Rights era and the Great Society. With the exceptions of the abolition of human slavery, the extension of voting rights to women, and the Americans for Disabilities Act, which was passed in 1990, that era saw just about all of our social programs. Everything from Social Security and laws supporting unions to Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start.
All the things that the conservatives are trying to repeal and turn around at this point.
They're trying to repeal took place during that one remarkable period between 1930, 32, 33, and somewhere in the early to mid-1970s. And with the 1970s, and especially with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, the atmosphere in this country changed. And we became a nation that was very hostile to the concept of social welfare, social justice, very hostile to the concept that government can be an instrument for good in looking after the welfare of everyone who lives subject to its power. The animal rights movement was created by the impulse of the 1960s, or that period between the 30s and the 60s. It was the spirit of that movement that created and still infuses the animal rights movement. But we came into being, say, with the publication of Peter Singer's Animal Liberation in 1975. We came into being just as that era was dying. And we have had to grow up in an environment that is extremely hostile to animal rights movements. You might say that animal rights is the orphan child of the 1960s. It's having to scratch out its its own living on the streets in a very hostile environment.
Okay, so our timing wasn't good, but it's also a much bigger challenge. We're not talking about humans, and we're not even nice to humans still. I mean, we still do horrible things all over the world and to ourselves, just like you were talking about how the conservatives are taking away so many of the benefits that help poor people, disadvantaged people. We're bringing out all that bad stuff that's embedded in our psyche.
Yes, it is true. It is truly an appalling situation.
Yeah. So we need to do some educating, and you recommend educating the left on the importance of showing that all of the oppressed get equal value, regardless of species.
Exactly so, because animal rights is consistent with the fundamental philosophy of the left. It is inconsistent with the fundamental philosophy of the right. The fundamental philosophy of the left is mutual assistance, cooperation, mutual caring. The fundamental philosophy of the right is competitiveness, mutual warfare, if you will, social Darwinism. As Herbert Spencer put it, root hog or die, is the without any help from your neighbor, is the fundamental philosophy of conservatism.
Mm.
And that philosophy is hostile to both human rights and animal rights. The left is halfway there. The left understands the need for mutual caring and mutual concern and collective responsibility for one another. The left understands the true meaning of community in a way that the right does not. And the left, for example, understands the evils of racism. What they don't understand is that speciesism is simply the most extreme version of racism.
Mm-hmm.
The left understands the evils of sexism. They don't understand that laying hens and dairy cows, for instance, are victims of the worst kind of sexism. They suffer and die because they're female. So the left is halfway there and has a fundamental orientation that is compatible with animal rights, that is friendly toward animal rights, or should be, that the right does not. And therefore, I think it is very important that we consider ourselves a social justice movement among other social justice movements, and that we work very hard to form a unified front with the political left.
You are a Tibetan Buddhist.
Yes.
How did that happen, and how does that fit with your philosophy about animals?
I don't really know how it happened. I was raised a Southern Baptist and a Methodist, and I just did not personally find that a satisfying a spiritual practice for me. I understand that there are many people for whom it is, and I certainly respect that, but it just wasn't for me. And I just started looking around, and I came across Tibetan Buddhism, and it worked for me. I studied for 12 years with a Tibetan Lama, and found it very satisfying, both intellectually and spiritually. It works for me because the fundamental ethical value of Buddhism is compassion for all sentient beings based upon empathy. And I think that is also the basis for the animal rights movement. Compassion for all sentient beings based upon empathy.
Hmm.
I think the two dovetail perfectly for me.
Now, are Tibetan Buddhists normally vegetarian, or they're not?
Sadly enough, they're not.
Yeah. You mentioned the different religions and how many of them had elements that would encourage vegetarianism, and how some have kind of gotten off the path.
Yes, there among Buddhists worldwide, all schools of Buddhism, an educated guess, there are no real statistics, but an educated guess would be that about half are vegetarian. Among Tibetan Buddhists, the number is far lower. But there are Tibetan Buddhists and important teachers among Tibetan Buddhists who are vegetarian, And the number of young lamas who are growing up in India and Nepal and in the West who are vegetarian is growing, and I think that's a very hopeful sign.
Yes, and well, unfortunately, there's a lot of human rights issues, too, in Tibet and many other places.
There are. Very tragic situation.
Very tragic. Thank you, human beings.
We strike again.
Oh, okay. Let's see. We just have just a handful minutes left. So what? I remember a long time ago when I was becoming an activist that I was thinking about the world as like a timeline and that some of us had to be super, super extreme in order to move the mainstream a little bit over in the middle. And that's what I was thinking of when you were talking about these people that really believe only in approving things that will benefit animals wholly rather than marginal steps to get them to a better place. And I like to side with I'm an idealist, and I think I like to stick with the idealist, but I do realize that we need to have this middle ground where we take small steps to ultimately achieve the goal. We need to move people over more in the middle, and we need to have those that are more extreme in order to find a safe place in the middle that people will agree to.
Yes, we absolutely need both camps. I have no argument with the folks who argue and campaign exclusively for veganism and exclusively for the abolition of all animal exploitation. I myself believe absolutely and wholeheartedly that a vegan world and the abolition of all animal exploitation are the only morally adequate solution to the problem. But I also believe at the same time that in addition to vegan advocacy and abolitionist advocacy, we need to push partial steps, indirect steps. We need to push things like flexitarianism. We need to push things like cage-free facilities for laying hens, things that move us, just nudge us a little bit toward the goal. I think the two strategies complement one another. I think they support one another. And where the wheels fall off for me is where people say we should only pursue abolitionist vegan advocacy and not the other. We need to pursue both equally.
Yeah, I think what's sad is that there's a little bit too much energy that goes towards the disagreement between the two groups, and I would really like to see just everyone say, okay, that's what you want to do, fine, it's all part of the fight, and I'm going to work over here and work on my projects.
Could not agree more. We waste entirely too many resources, too much time, too much energy.
Yeah.
Criticizing people that we disagree with on points of strategy.
Okay, well, I think we've come to the end of the half hour, and I want to thank you for the work that you do and for writing Changing the Game, Why the Battle for Animal Liberation is So Hard and How We Can Win It. Another wonderful Lantern Books publication. We had Martin Rowe on the program last week.
Lantern's a great publisher, and I love them.
Yeah, some of my favorite books are from Lantern, the books that no one else will publish.
they're performing a tremendous service.
Yes. Well, thank you, Norm, and enjoy the hot weather, and stay cool and keep fighting the good fight.
Thank you so much for having me, Karen.
Okay. Thank you, Norm. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Join me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. We're going to have a brand new food show up very soon. I'm really excited about it with some great barbecue recipes, and we'll be introducing the Swinging Gourmets, which I know you've heard about. So please look out for that, and have a delicious week.